Hello and welcome to episode 14 of The Good, The Bad, and The Wretched. My name is Josh, and with me as always is Chris.
What's happening?
We're from the video graveyard, and this episode is going to be about one of our favorite companies, especially when we were growing up, Troma.
Welcome to Tromaville, bitches.
Now, this might be a bit of a weird episode, just because I noticed that there's been three Lionel Richie references in the 5 minutes before we recorded. So I don't know what's up with that, but
hello.
And
is it me you're looking for?
Brickhouse.
Well, yes.
And then three times a lady.
That's true.
So I don't know. Hopefully this will be as easy as Sunday morning, but
I was gonna say another insult, but I decided to, since we're in the house, I've decided to leave it alone.
In the house.
In the house.
In the house, just down the street from
the murder house or suicide house.
Suicide house. So just at the street from the house that we're recording, a few years ago, there was a person hung themselves. And they were hanging around for about a year.
I get it.
In the house.
That's nasty.
It's super nasty. And like in the house, I guess what happened is the house had been abandoned for a number of years. So when this guy went and hung himself in the house, the doors and windows were kind of open. So I guess animals came in and were like eating the corpse.
Ugh.
And I guess when they found the corpse after it had been hanging there for a year, it was mummified and half eaten.
I guess it wasn't a house of fun.
No, it's gross.
Yeah, that's pretty nasty.
Anyway, I'm kind of wondering partially if it's an urban legend of the neighborhood, but I don't think so. I mean, always been a weird house.
Didn't you also say it's torn down now, though?
It's torn down, but I mean, when they were taking stuff out of there, they like took out like an airplane wing and shit, like, and
really,
and an old like dilapidated car, and just a weird.
I'm gonna imagine it's like your neighborhood, this neighborhood's Texas Chainsaw House.
It was creepy. It was like a single rancher, but it was like obscured by like bushes and stuff, like you couldn't really see it. And like the rumor has been like since forever that like animals lived in the house because it's abandoned like most of the time, but I guess the owner came back and just hung himself in it, and then no one knew that the corpse was in there.
Wasn't it down in a gully too?
It's down a little bit of a hill, but yeah, it's super super creepy.
Did they ever find out why he hung himself?
No. And and the creepier thing is, I guess these kids went in and were filming in the house something. I don't know if they were just, I don't know if they just knew it was abandoned. Maybe they didn't know the story, or maybe they were there for kicks, but it's just a fucked up story.
It sounds like a found footage movie.
It does, doesn't it? It's just so out of a horror movie, maybe because I've seen so many. Like I just
imagine them like filming in the house, and then they come upon one of them standing in the corner like in Blair Witch.
Totally. Like I get freaked out. I actually won't drive by the house at night now.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I won't even drive down that street now.
Huh.
But, you know, it's weird how your mind does that, right? I mean, it's after so many years of horror movies, of course, that's where my mind always goes, to like the creepiest fucking thing that there can be.
Yep.
And,
the morbidity.
Know, sure. It's fine, but I won't walk up there at night. Yeah.
Now is the neighborhood, is it actually tagged as Suicide House, or is that just a terminology?
No, we
that
just
you
came
up
with that on our own. But
we're like, it's the Suicide House.
Yeah, but it's super creepy, and there's still fencing around it and stuff. So I don't know, man.
Yeah, there's been fencing around that house since I started coming here, and that was like 5-6 years ago.
Yeah,
now
the whole thing's weird.
Yeah, it's a bit strange. Yeah. Bit strange.
Anyway, on that cheery note. Yeah, so we're going to talk about Troma tonight. So
we definitely started off on a very high note.
Yeah, sorry to bring everyone down, guys. Okay, so as usual, we're going to go through what we've been up to lately.
Uh-huh.
So I guess, Chris, why don't you get started?
Okay, I only have two things that I watched. The first one I watched was a actual documentary that I watched last night called His Name Was Jason.
Oh.
30 Years of Friday the 13th.
Sweet.
Which, it's kind of like, it's from Daniel Ferrans, who did the Crystal Lake Memories one, which is like the 6-hour documentary about the entire Friday series. And I feel like this was like his training wheels in a way, because it's a 90-minute documentary. It's aired on Stars, I believe.
Right.
Because the DVD is put out by Anchor Bay. And it's about you know, Friday the 13th being 30 years old. It's hosted by Tom Savini.
Okay.
It's filmed on, it was filmed in 2008, around there, when they had at Universal Horror, they had a Friday the 13th exhibit at their haunted house. So it was filmed on those sets his narration.
Okay, I wish I was there for that one.
And it's really, I felt like it was really for, not really for hardcore fans. It was more for those casual people who are just kind of like discovering Friday the 13th and don't really know much about it. Because a lot of the stuff they talked about was very glossed over and like common knowledge for Friday fans, right?
Yeah.
And they definitely tried to cram a lot into the 90 minutes, which made it super scattershot. It was just, it kind of had no real flow to it because it went through different sections where it was about, you know, Jason as a character, try and delve into his psychology of Jason, which I don't give a shit about, to be honest. I mean, I didn't care about it when they tried to do it with Michael Myers. Why would I care about it with Jason? Because Jason's got even less real personality than Michael Myers, if you think about it.
Yeah, totally.
So who cares? It went over the, it was cool because it interviewed everybody who played Jason.
Oh, that's cool.
So, I mean, it covered...
Parker was in there, too?
Yep.
Nice.
It covered everybody. Then it had a section about the final girls. It had a section about, you know, all those kind of things. And it was kind of entertaining, but it's not something I'd watch again. And I feel like if you have Crystal Lake memories out there, there's really no purpose behind this.
Right.
So that was that one.
Cool.
And the only other thing I watched was a movie called Ants with an exclamation point.
Oh, this is the one with Suzanne Summers?
Ants, yes.
Has that wicked VHS box with
does.
The boobs and... sorry, Melissa. The boobs and the ants.
The boobs and the ants.
Yeah.
It's a 70s... 1977, made for TV movie. It's one of those movie of the weeks kind of thing. And like Josh said, Suzanne Summers is in it in a minor kind of role, but it was filled with like minor celebrities of the time. You know, Bernie Casey was in it as the token black guy.
Nice.
And it's
Dr. Black.
Dr. Black. And it's about a resort town. It's about this resort called Lakewood Manor, and there's construction going on around it with all these other lakeside shores, and this businessman comes to town with Suzanne Summers, who's his, like, assistant, and they want to buy the place out. And at the same time, there's these ants there that have been mutated by pesticides. DDT. Nice. You down with DDT? Yeah, you know me. And they totally start attacking people. And it's kind
of
like
fire ants?
No, just regular ants.
Nice.
So it's kind of like a disaster movie of the 70s mixed with killer insects and minor characters. It was sort of dull, actually.
Does it have that scene that's on the cover? Is that in the movie?
No, not quite.
Oh.
Suzanne Summers does get attacked while wrapped in a bedsheet after she had sex with her boss.
Ooh.
But it's a TV movie from the 70s.
Right.
So there's multiple flashbacks, though, to her lying on the floor with topless, with her boobs squished against the floor with ants crawling on her. They flash back to that at least three times.
So that's the cover,
during
right?
the movie.
Is that...
No, the
is
cover
is... Suzanne Summers' boobs on the cover?
I don't think so. It's just a girl squeezing her boobs together with like,
ants all over them.
Ants all over them. It's kind of erotic, but kind of disturbingly erotic. And it wasn't great.
Dis-erotic?
Dis-erotic. It was kind of... It was...
E-rubing?
Yeah, stop coming up with trying to come up with terminology that'll never get put into Urban Dictionary, buddy. But it wasn't that great. It was kind of boring, but there were some priceless moments. There was a scene with this 10-year-old boy who he's hunting down empty bottles so that his mom, who's just divorced from their dad, can cash them in to help out the family, you know, recycle the bombs. Such a sweet kid. But he crawls into this dumpster and... He comes out covered in ants, and he comes running to his mom, mommy, 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 caked in these ants, and like dives into the pool because he's getting bitten, and they have to resuscitate him and stuff like that. Brian Dennehy's in it as a police chief. Really early role for Brian Dennehy. There's this really...
Brian Dennehy as a police chief? Yeah. Weird.
That never happens. And there's this just this like really unexciting scene where they try and save the people from the second floor of the hotel using a fire truck ladder. And there's the chick who's the hippie chick who earlier is free love and all that. She's hanging off the end of the ladder and she's like, oh my God. And you're like, oh, is she going to fall? And I'm just like, who gives a shit? At least then the ants will have somebody to eat, right?
Nice.
They don't really attack that many people.
Do they ever actually eat? Like, do they like
they attack
piranha
people.
Anyone or?
No, well, they're little tiny ants. Dude.
Yeah, but enough of them.
But it's funny because if you pay close attention to the movie, you can see where they've sprayed this sticky shit on the ground so that all the ants cluster there. So, I mean, it is what it is. It's a 70s TV movie, so take from that what you will.
It would be a pretty awful way to go, though. I mean, they being can get by into ants? Every crevice, right?
All their pincers?
Ew.
Yeah. They crawl into your dick hole?
I wasn't quite thinking that.
It'd be
that,
even worse if they were fire ants,
it
man.
It would really suck if it was going up there. Oh, my God.
Your urethra is on fire.
Catheters, but
that's anyway. That's for our medical episode.
Yeah, I don't ever want to see that shit. It's funny. There hasn't been more catheters in horror movies.
Well, you know,
it is one of the most horrifying things.
Imagine like a horror movie where they put a catheter in then they show it in close up being pulled out really fast and like blood spraying over the walls.
Oh my God.
And then at the same time,
or like a catheter with sandpaper on the outside.
Yeah, and then
at
the same time, the killer's holding the piss bag and like spraying it in the victim's face. This is getting too.
Whoa, you just went way over the line.
This is getting too
dude.
Disgusting even for me. Okay, that's all I watch. What do you got?
Oh, fuck. Wow.
On that pleasant note, suicide and catheters.
That's what happens
don't
when
do
you
it.
Mix cold medicine and beer.
Suicide and catheters. Don't do it.
Okay, okay. I think the word catheter isn't going to come up again.
Catheter.
Ooh. Gross. Okay. So I went. Whoa. Okay. So I guess
catheter.
No. Okay. So the next movie. Holy shit. Okay. So the movie I watched was Friday the 13th Part 8.
This is a surprise.
Shocking. Jason Takes Manhattan.
Yeah. Right. He did.
So listen. I didn't think this was that bad.
Are you fucking kidding?
I'm not kidding.
Seriously.
I enjoyed it.
This is like the worst one apart from 5.
I enjoyed myself.
Why?
Well,
explain to me.
Okay. It opened up with this like super like cheesy 80s song playing over these like streets of like Manhattan all like.
Yeah, this is like the cock tease that never happens.
No, but it was like totally like that 80s like yeah. action movie song.
It reminded me of the beginning
showing
of that.
Showing like all the junkies and shit. And I was like, oh, this is pretty cool.
Kind of reminded me of the beginning of that 1984 Abel Ferrara movie, Fear City.
Yeah, it was totally like yeah. that. Like that. Or, yeah, like all those
but
80s
But it doesn't have as cool
movies.
A song as Fear City.
What did Fear City have?
New York Dolls. You're so pretty.
That was such an awesome movie. I got to watch Fear City.
Abel Ferrara is awesome. Miss 45.
Well,
man.
Abel Ferrara was
apart from Driller
awesome.
Killer.
Yeah, apart from Driller Killer.
Miss 45, man, all the way. But
Miss
anyway.
Miss 45 is awesome. So does the Bad Lieutenant. It's pretty awesome, too.
Anyway,
so there was that. And so I was like, okay, I was getting into it pretty quick. And then when we got to, so, well, secondly, it was shot here in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of cool seeing some of that stuff because a lot of it, like, there's this part where they're getting onto this boat. That was all shot in an area of Vancouver called Britannia Beach. And I could totally recognize stuff from out there because I remember hearing years ago that the boat was still there for years and years and years afterwards. And it's burned down since. But
that'd
it,
be unfortunate. That'd be cool to go check out.
Yeah, but it was there. And I wish I was more of a fan back when I drove by that all the time. At any rate, so they're getting onto the boat. And who do I see? But Reverend Snow from Three's Company. So Chrissy's father, who is, if you're a Three's Company fan like I am, it's one of my favorite shows of all time. I totally recognize him, even though he only was in a few episodes of Three's Company, but he made a big impact. But he was like the old guy on the boat, like mm-hmm. the kind of teacher asshole guy.
So interestingly enough, we've now tied both of the movies I watched in with the movie you watched. Because
both of the movies?
Suzanne Summers.
Oh, yeah.
And his name was Jason.
Wow. Synergy, man.
This is fucking weird.
That is really weird.
Catheter.
So, anyway, so I was pretty excited when I saw him right away.
Yeah.
And then we also, and I, one thing I did remember about this movie is the kind of rocker chick named, I think her name was JJ or something.
Yeah.
And she gets killed by a flying V guitar.
Yeah. Wasn't she, didn't, was she, the, she had like the spiky. She, there's that scene where she goes down into like the boiler room of the ship to yeah. jam out on her guitar.
Totally.
She's like, oh yeah, I'm totally getting this. Let me go.
Yeah.
She's like the Joan Jett, only sucky.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't, I don't know who she reminded me of, but I actually,
she reminded
remembered
me of Joan,
her.
She reminded me of a sucky Joan Jett.
Yeah. I remembered her quite clearly though. Like she was what I remembered from this movie. Turns out she's only in the movie for like 5 minutes. But it turns out that she's the daughter of the lead singer of a band called Chilliwack from here.
Oh yeah.
Do you know Chilliwack?
Gone, 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 she becomes
yeah,
so long.
That's his daughter, Saffron Henderson.
Chilliwack, the band whose claim to fame is, hey, we need to name our band. Let's get out a map of BC and point randomly at something. Chilliwack.
I know they were big. I just don't know if they were big anywhere else.
Well, I don't know. Why don't some listeners who don't live in BC let us know?
Yeah, that would be great.
I'm curious about that.
So there was a couple of other things I really dug about this movie. There was this black guy.
Oh, that guy.
So a couple of things about him, because he was like the total like take charge, like tough black guy character. But it was so funny because when they got to New York, he got like super caricature, like stupid black guy.
Like, what do you mean?
Like, he's just like, oh, New York, yeah. Like, it was just so stupid.
Oh, shit, I got stormy some cocaine.
Like, he just got so uncool so quickly. It was the weirdest thing. And it was like, just for this entire sequence where they're seeing the Statue of Liberty, he just gets super uncool, but then he gets back to cool again. And then he's
like, where the peep show's at?
But then there's a scene where he actually tries to box.
That's the best scene
Jason.
In the movie, Prue. But for all the wrong reasons.
To box with Jason on box. This rooftop.
Yeah, no, that doesn't happen.
And he's like boxing him and like doing body shots and stuff. And then Jason just one punch knocks his head off. It was so wicked.
It was awesome because it like fell off the roof and then landed in a
totally
dumpster, didn't it?
Did. So that was pretty rad.
Do you know what my favorite scene in that whole movie though is?
What?
Is when he first comes up into Times Square. Yeah. And the camera like spins around him while he's just sitting in there heavy breathing like, oh yeah, this is my town.
Totally.
I'm like, too bad it took you a fucking hour and 15 minutes to get there. And then the scene with the punk rockers is awesome.
Oh yeah.
When like, he like kicks over their boombox. That is the best scene.
Sorry, man. This was, I love this.
I liked it.
Yeah. And then of course, spoiler alert, anyone, turn it down if you don't want to hear the ending, but I am going to talk about
that.
The ending sucks. The fact that in New York City, apparently the subway or the sewer tunnels get flooded with toxic waste.
Periodically.
Every day. Apparently. At a certain time, which was pretty awesome. I enjoyed this for what it was, for a complete stupid B-movie. I don't know how I feel about it as part of the Friday the 13th canon, but yeah. I really enjoyed the movie.
I think my issue with it is that if you're going to call your movie Jason Takes Manhattan, at least have him in Manhattan for more than 15 minutes.
He was in Manhattan, yeah.
He was on that boat.
It was
fucking,
on the boat for
like an hour and whatever. I mean, he killed a couple people pretty cool on the boat, but I don't know. That ending sucked.
He did. But I mean, I did like Reverend Snow. I thought he was a perfect asshole. And just some of the stuff that was coming out of his mouth was pretty hilarious. And everything was so overacted. Are you kids doing drugs?
But that that final girl, that Jensen Daggett chick.
Yeah.
She was annoying as fuck in that movie, but she's super hot.
Yeah,
now.
She was cute.
She's super hot now.
Oh, is she really?
Yeah, and that his name was Jason. I'm like, holy shit.
Wow.
But I mean, she was useless. She's like one of the worst final girls in the entire series.
Yeah, I mean, as a Friday the 13th movie, I didn't find it was very good.
Because she suffered from all those stupid dream sequences like, my dad's going to teach me how to swim. Uh-oh, Jason's there. Oh, shit, Jason just busts through the window and his hold is choking me and all this stuff.
Yeah, she had a water phobia and...
But she's on a fucking cruise ship.
Yeah. And there was also this weird thing where Jason could teleport all of a sudden.
Well, he's always been able to teleport, dude.
I don't remember it being like that. Like, he was, like, walking one way.
The best was when he teleported.
And he's on the other side.
The best was when he teleported and that guy was climbing the mast and he fucking teleported and pulled him off the mast. I'm like, where the hell did he come from?
Totally. There was a couple of notable people in here as well, other than Peter Mark Richmond, who was Reverend Snow, and Saffron Henderson. It also had Gordon Curry, who was in a great Canadian movie called Blood and Donuts, if you haven't seen it.
Yeah.
But this was an early role of his. And actually, Gordon Curry moved down to L.A. shortly after making this and was actually roommates with Brad Pitt while they were both trying to get started.
That Blood and Donuts is kind of interesting because it's like a vampire movie.
Yeah.
But it's got that indie bent to it.
Yeah, like David Cronenberg's got like a cameo. And
I don't remember really caring for it when I originally saw it, but I mean, I'm curious about
watching it again. Yeah, I saw it at the film festival up here, and I know Curry was there along with the director. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was pretty fun, but I haven't seen it since. But I had the poster on my wall forever. And another person that was, who else was in this? Oh, Kelly Hugh. She was like a martial arts chick.
Yep.
She was in Martial Law with Sammo Hung. So just kind of a weird, she was like a really, really token 80s Asian girl in this.
Yeah.
But yeah, she went on to become kind of a kick-ass martial artist afterwards.
Speaking of posters, have you seen the like poster for this movie though? The really awesome one that they had to pull?
No.
The friggin' where it was I Love New York thing, but it was Jason cutting through I Love New York, and where the heart is in I Love New York was Jason's mask.
Really?
It's like it got totally pulled because the New York Tourist Commission like tried to sue them and everything.
Oh, no
and
way.
And I know you can buy reproductions of that poster now, and I totally would hang that on my wall, even though I don't really care for the movie that much just because it's so awesome.
Oh. I like the movie. I don't know, man.
I don't know.
I mean, I don't know. Like, I don't know if I'd recommend it, but I think it would be a fun, like, party movie night thing.
If you constantly made fun of it, maybe.
I definitely had more fun watching this than I had watching Part 5. So, again, I keep ripping on Part 5, but Part 5, I think, like Part 5 is going to be the worst of the series.
I said that 8 is better than 5, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, it was bad, but it was bad in some good ways.
I just think it was misguided.
Yeah. Oh, definitely misguided.
You know, there's more misguidedness coming for you as you continue on your path.
Well, I've only got 3 more left.
They're an interesting batch.
Anyway, next up is Jason Goes to Hell, I guess.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it's the second movie in the series that called itself the last one.
Yeah.
Because it was Jason Goes to Hell, the final Friday, and we all know how... the final chapter worked out.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah,
for sure. Okay, the other movie I watched, I haven't really been up to too much lately, but I did watch a movie called Blue Ruin from 2013.
Yeah. I want to see this.
Yeah, it's really good. So this is a revenge movie, and it's a real slow burn. So this is the type of movie you want to watch by yourself. It's not really one to watch with friends. It's one you want to really just sort of kick back and immerse yourself in. I watched it fairly late at night, and it's really good, but it's a very quiet movie. You really need to, even some of the dialogue, it's kind of hard to hear. You got to really pay attention to it. And it's a revenge movie, but it's not typical in that, a lot of the times when we watch revenge movies, the protagonist is usually able to exact some sort of revenge on those who've wronged him, but there's always some like intricate plot and he's, real badass and stuff like this. This is a guy that would be like you or I, like some guy who, something shitty had happened and they're going out for revenge, but you don't fucking know what you're doing.
Right.
And you're like fucking up all over the place and making mistakes. And, it's a really interesting movie, and it was on a number of top 10 lists from last year, and I can see why. I wouldn't call it a horror movie at all. It's a revenge sort of thriller, I guess you could say. It definitely had some intense moments, and I'd really recommend it. The director, Jeremy Solnier.
Butcher name.
He made a movie called Murder Party. I haven't seen that. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't. I've heard it's pretty good.
Yeah, I heard it's pretty good too. And then he's got a movie coming out called Green Room. That's about, I think it's about like a sort of a punk rock slasher movie. So interested to see what he's doing next. But this was really good, really well made, and highly recommended.
So this is a revenge movie that's probably the opposite of a revenge movie like Savage Streets.
Yeah, like where this is like
Savage Streets has Linda Blair with a motherfucking crossbow, whereas Blue Ruin's probably more serious and downbeat. And
yeah, it's interesting because
this isn't Charlie Bronson just blasting people. Then
no, this guy like he's kind of conflicted with what he's doing, and he's not awesome at revenge. Like it's I find a lot of revenge movies like they decide to take revenge and all of a sudden it's
everything
like
snaps.
They know exactly
place.
What they're doing, but this guy has no fucking idea.
If I set this bomb up four Sundays from now, when he's coming by here, I'm gonna blow that motherfucker up.
Yeah,
that's
exactly
revenge.
Exactly. It's not like that at all.
Okay.
But and I had a couple of interesting cameos too. Devin Rattray, I believe his name is. He was the guy who played Buzz, like the asshole brother in Home Alone.
Oh, okay.
He had a significant role in this, an important role anyway, and really interesting to see. And he, really brought a foundation to the movie, and not expected from someone like that, because, I didn't even know what happened to that kid. But, yeah, does a solid turn there. And then there's also a small role from Jan Brady, or Eve Plum, But her role is very small, but it was interesting to see her pop up there for a few minutes. Anyway.
Jim Brady.
Yeah, from the Brady Bunch.
Marsha.
Exactly. Yeah, so that's all I got. But yeah, I'd highly recommend Blue Ruin. It's been getting a lot of buzz and well worth it.
So what we've gathered from these four things we talked about is that really only Blue Ruin's worth seeing.
I guess so. But it's definitely worth seeing. Okay, so I guess we'll get right into to Troma. So Troma, I mean, obviously is for people that have grown up in the 80s. I mean, in the 80s, I mean, that's when I was a teenager and, you know, and video stores were everything. And Troma was a huge part of my life.
Yeah, like for us, because of our age, in the 80s, that was when we were developing our tastes.
Mm-hmm.
So Troma was there and we were like, who is this company? They made such bizarre movies. I mean, there was a lot of bizarre shit in the 80s, but these guys, they just had dedication to the bizarre in the 80s. So, I mean, that's why they're still known and why they're still around 40 years later, right?
Yeah, and they very quickly built a brand. And, you know, once you figured it out, once you started renting and started becoming knowledgeable about B-movies in any way, shape, or form, you knew what a Troma movie was. And yep. Like, even as you were just getting started, they were very good at promoting themselves. I remember back in the day, you'd rent a VHS or I guess rent a DVD, but more VHS when we were growing up. But they'd have like little special features. They'd always have trailers before the feature of other Troma movies that you'd want to check out that would make you want to go seek these other ones out. And it seemed like fucking they for whatever reason, they were like distribution masters. Like every video store had tons of Troma movies, I found. And so they were very easy to come by. And I mean, I totally remember like being in love with Troma when I was getting into horror movies and B movies. And I mean, I think the first one I came across was obviously Toxic Avenger.
Yep.
And that's Toxic Avengers kind of become their flagship and their mascot. But it's a very special part of our lives.
Yeah, and it always will be because Troma has their own identity. They're a company that you just know if you're into B-movies, and there's a reason there's a terminology now that's called it's a Troma movie.
Yeah.
You know, there's certain things that happen in movies that gets it pegged as a Troma movie, you know? There's like the excessive nudity. There's like the off-color humor. There's that just bizarre certain types of genres bumping up against each other, bumping uglies as it were. And you know, there's that stock footage of the car flipping that they've used awesome. Over and over and over again since Sergeant Kabuki Man. And you know, there's Lloyd Kaufman, who's like the craziest spokesman a company could ever need, because you know, he goes with it. He's a smart dude, but he just plays up this clown prince of B movies like you've never seen before. I mean, Roger Corman, smart guy too, another guy who established himself with New World Concord and all those, and you know, he's a legendary producer as well, but he's kind of behind the scenes, whereas Lloyd Kaufman's like out there and he's just like, yep, this is my company, this is what we're doing, we support indie cinema, and you know, you got to respect his message. So let's talk a little bit about how Troma began.
Okay, well, Troma was founded in 1974 by Lloyd Kaufman and Michael Herz.
Yeah.
And since then, they've produced, acquired, and distributed over 1,000 movies, which is crazy impressive.
Pretty impressive.
So I'd just like to talk a bit about how Lloyd got started.
Yep.
So Lloyd started out, he's sort of bounced between making his own movies and working on other people's movies. So his first attempt at a feature film was a movie called The Girl Who Returned in 1969. I personally haven't seen this one, but that was sort of where he got started. In that time period as well, he also started working for, of all things, Canon Films, and worked on a movie called Joe in 1970.
Yeah,
have you seen Joe?
I haven't.
So that's this movie. It's basically this, I can't remember how it starts, but this guy gets into some sort of trouble and hooks up with Peter Boyle, who's like this total like asshole hippie hater. And it's kind of one of those downbeat early 70s. Just kind of anti everything movies.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing about Joe is it was directed by a guy named John Avildsen, who went on to direct Rocky and The Karate Kid.
Yeah.
So Lloyd and John started developing a friendship, and Lloyd then decided to make a second feature, and this one was called The Battle of Love's Return, which is a little more known. This was in 1971. Again, I haven't seen it, but, you know, Lloyd really was getting his feet wet here. He directed, wrote, starred, produced, composed, and edited this movie. So he had his fingers in every slice of the production process. Mm-hmm. From there, he went
another
on.
Thing about Battle of Love's Return is... is that Oliver Stone was in it.
Oh, was he? Nice.
He had a minor acting role in it. He shows up in a really hideous looking fur coat.
Oh, really? That's funny.
So, because he was apparently, I think it's the story is that he was roommates with Oliver Stone in Yale.
Kaufman was?
Yes.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, something along those lines. I'm not 100% sure of the story.
And that makes sense. I mean, like Corman, like Troma and Lloyd Kaufman did have a tendency to... be able to give a lot of people their starts, and we'll get into a little bit more of that later, but that does fit into that as well. So from then, Lloyd became the production manager on a movie called Cry Uncle that was directed by Avildsen. And this, you know, we were starting to see like some of the, you know, some of the things that Troma became known for, like, made their appearance in this movie. Like, there was a lot of sex. It had, you know, some humor that was maybe not as, you know, a little off from the Three Stooges. It was violent, and there was a scene of necrophilia.
That's Troma.
Yeah. So from there, Lloyd went on to associate produce Silent Night, Bloody Night. So again, staying in the genre, staying in kind of weird B movies, that type of thing. And then he went on to executive produce a movie called Sugar Cookies in 1973. And this one... this is where he was like combining like an art film with an exploitation film. This one starred Mary Warrenov and Lynn Lowry, who went on to be in I Drink Your Blood. And this is kind of, you know, we're starting to get into movies that, you know, when you know Troma, you hear these titles kicking around. From there, Lloyd delved into adult cinema a little bit, and he made a few movies there. One was called The Newcomers.
Yeah.
And another one was called, I think, Sweet and Sour.
I don't know why I just feel like busting out a Beavis and Butthead laugh when you're talking about this.
And then one called Divine Obsession. And, you know, there's nothing really to note about these movies. I know Jamie Gillis was in a couple of them, but nothing. They're not like, I don't think they're classics in adult cinema or anything like that. He also worked on a couple of other notable movies at the time. He was a production manager on a movie called My Dinner with Andre. And it's a pretty good movie. It's Louis Malle, I believe, is the director. And I remember Siskel and Ebert used to love this movie.
I kind of read somewhere, I'm not 100% sure on this fact either, that Troma actually helped fund that movie.
I think they might have. I do believe that's where maybe Lloyd was starting to get into production, because we're now in 1981. I mean, Troma was started in 1974, but really hadn't done anything too much of note.
Well, yeah, they started out with a handful of sex comedies.
Yeah.
There was about four sex comedies that came out that were like their productions.
Yeah.
Because they were mostly distributing at that time, but they actually came and they made the first Turn On and Squeeze Play.
Yeah, Squeeze Play was the first one in 1978. Yeah. And then they went through Waitress, Stuck on You, and the first Turn On in 1983.
Yeah. And they were all just your basic sex comedies. There was nothing really overly notable about them, I don't think. I just remember in Waitress there being a scene with a food fight that was kind of like what you would expect from that kind of movie. They're kind of like the Chuck Vincent 70s sex comedies, you know, like Hot T-Shirts and stuff like that, you know? Those kind of really bad, stereotyped nudity-filled romps, and there was nothing really notable about them. They were kind of movies that would play easily on 42nd Street to all the pervs in their trench coats.
And Lloyd directed all four of them, so he was getting, again, more experience, and these definitely had the Troma title on them. Like, these were Troma movies that he and hers put out together. But, I don't really have anything to note about them either, other than the fact that they are, when you think of Troma, like, they do come up quite often.
Yeah.
Like, they have re-released these titles over and over and over again.
Well, I was on eBay today looking at the sexy box to see if I could buy it for cheap, because it's all four of them in one DVD set.
Yeah.
So, they have their place.
Yeah. So as this was happening, Lloyd was also, you know, continuing to work on more Hollywood features as well. I think from what I understand, a big turning point came in 1980 when he worked on quite a big movie called The Final Countdown.
Mm-hmm.
That was, I believe it was about a aircraft carrier in the Bermuda Triangle.
Yeah.
And I think Lloyd was the associate producer on that one. And I think it's kind of being on that big of a movie, I think it really did kind of sour him on the whole Hollywood thing,
mm-hmm.
and make him want to go more of the indie route. At least that's what I understand without actually interviewing the guy.
Yeah.
He also, you know, just a couple other things he did. He was a post-production supervisor on Rocky. He was a location manager on Saturday Night Fever. So the legend is that, you know, Lloyd's the one who found the club that they danced in Saturday Night Fever and stuff. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he was still working on stuff like this, but I think after The Final Countdown, things changed.
Yeah.
Another big movie that he worked on at that time, but again, going into more of the indie world, was Mother's Day, which Troma put out, and Lloyd which also was associated with.
I love Mother's Day.
I've never seen Mother's Day, embarrassingly.
Mother's Day is your total early 80s hillbilly horror movie, kind of like the I Spit on Your Grave, Last House on the Left ilk, only with a lot more camp, because it's about these two girls who get kidnapped by these redneck brothers who are being told to kill by their kindly old mother.
That's awesome.
It's got the prerequisite rape. It's got the heavy duty violence. It's just a great movie. I it's sleazy as fuck. I mean, it's got a scene of someone being force-fed Drano, for fuck's sake.
Wow.
It's a great movie. The Blu-ray that's out from Anchor Bay Troma looks fucking amazing. And it was very loosely remade by Darren Lynn Bousman in 2010, I think it was.
Oh, really? Was it Rebecca De Mornay or something?
Yeah. Yeah, I haven't seen it because, for me, Mother's Day will always be the 1981.
Huh. I didn't know Bousman did that.
Yeah.
So Bousman's the director of a number of Saw movies.
Yeah.
And Repo, the Genetic Opera, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's kind of a cool director. But...
Yeah, it's interesting. Mother's Day is definitely where you started seeing Troma getting into that more exploitation side that they had. He also, in 1982, they also did a movie called When Nature Calls.
Right.
Which was an airplane-like spoof, you know, joke a minute and everything. And it's a great comedy. I actually have a lot of fun with it. It's got those fake commercials in the middle of the movie for no reason, all that stuff. And the thing that's interesting about both Mother's Day and When Nature Calls is they're both directed by Charles Kaufman, which is Lloyd's brother.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that.
So they're both very different movies because When Nature Calls is kind of like a PG, goofy comedy, and Mother's Day is just that hillbilly exploitation horror movie that's just like you're watching it and you're like, I can't believe they're doing this shit.
That's one of these ones I just never, it's just never gotten on my radar enough to watch.
I've loved Mother's Day since I saw it.
Yeah, I've loved that cover with those like two biker guys and it's like got one of them holding like a box with the mother's head in it.
Well, no, the mom's sitting in a rocking chair holding a box with a head in it.
Yeah.
And her two sons are in the background and one of them's got that biker thing, so he's got like the leather riding cap, and then the other one's got like a bag kind of thing over his head.
Nice.
It's a great movie.
Yeah, I heard that movie was actually shot on the same lake at the same time as Friday the 13th.
Oh, see, I don't know about that. I haven't heard about that, but
yeah, I think that's true. I'm not 100% on that.
But it is a great movie, and it is this kind of the early inklings of what's going to come next for them, because from there it came to the point where Lloyd and his partner Michael Herz, weren't really making the kind of money they thought they should be making because they were doing these sex comedies and everything. But then one day Michael came in and said, we need to make a horror movie. Those are big right now. So let's make a horror movie. And that brought us what? Toxic Avenger.
Yep. Toxic Avenger. And that's probably their most famous title,
which is
in 1984.
By far my most favorite Troma production. And the reason for that is it's my first Troma production.
Yeah, and I wonder about that. I mean, Toxie, I find, stands the test of time.
I still think it's a great movie.
Yeah, it still works. And even after all this time, and even after seeing it, you know, I probably watch it maybe every 5 years or so, and I still enjoy it every time. It hasn't lost anything.
Well, I remember the first time I actually heard about Troma was I was watching one of those like entertainment magazine TV shows, you know, like Entertainment Tonight or Inside Edition or whatever those shows were back then. And they had a profile on Troma.
Nice.
And it had lots of clips of their movies, and it had lots of Toxic Avenger clips. And I saw those clips. And I believe it was the scenes in the movie where Toxie's eliminating these guys in a Mexican restaurant.
I love that scene.
And I'm just like, I need to see this.
Yeah.
And then happened to be not much longer after I saw that TV clip, my grandmother visited from England.
Your grandma bought you the best shit.
I've told this story before, but she bought me Toxic Avenger, the unrated version on VHS.
That's wicked.
And that was my first exposure to Toxie.
Yeah.
And, you know, the thing about Toxie is it's not a horror movie. It really isn't.
Yeah, no, it's like a superhero B movie.
Yeah, it's not a horror movie. It always gets grouped as a horror movie, but that series is not horror.
Yeah, he's not a monster out to kill people.
No, like, he's the monster hero, for fuck's sake.
Yeah.
He's here to save everybody.
Monster hero, for fuck's sake.
Yeah, it's from, you know, it's about a corrupt town, and Toxie fights them all because he's like a 98-pound weakling called Melvin Ferd.
Yeah.
And he works at this local gym, and one day, truck of toxic waste rolls through Tromaville, parks right out front of the gym while the driver snorts himself some big bags of cocaine. And Melvin gets picked on enough that he runs down the hall, jumps out the second story window, and lands in a vat of toxic waste.
While wearing a tutu,
which he's being tricked into by one of the chicks who showed her boobs beforehand, which would trick almost any guy into wearing a pink tutu. And from there, he transforms into a hideously deformed creature of superhuman size and strength, as we're reminded many times throughout the history of the Toxic Avenger series. And I just think there's some fun stuff in the first one. There's like his mom, who's the typical stereotyped Jewish mother, knocking at the door when he's like transforming in the bathtub. And he's like, oh God, oh God. And his skin's all bubbling and all that. And then at the end, he finally transforms into Toxic Avenger. And he does this manly roar, like, roar, roar. Yeah. And she's like, my little Melvin, he must have finally hit puberty.
Yeah, totally.
You know, it's just jokes like that. And the makeup effects in Toxie are really awesome. They were done by this girl called Jennifer Aspinall. And she also did Street Trash.
She did, yeah.
Which I feel is kind of like a heir to Troma movies in a way. It wasn't made by Troma, but it totally could have been.
Totally, yeah.
Because it's about bums exploding from tainted moonshine. Yeah. So, I mean, it feels like a Troma movie. They're both New York movies. But the thing about Toxie is that even though it was a monster hero, there was satire in it. There was bizarre comedy. There was gore galore.
Yeah, I mean, like, just mentioning Jennifer Aspinall, I mean, the makeup effects in this movie were, they weren't subpar. Like, this was...
No, they were super awesome for the
really
budget
good
level.
And I think that's a lot of the reason why Toxie hit, because, even though it was a goofy movie, the effects were at the same level as some of the masters. And I'm thinking of, like, some of the makeup effects masters. Aspinall's name does come to mind.
Yeah.
Even though she only really did those two movies, I think she's done some other stuff.
Well, she's still working.
Those were the two she's known for, but they were both pretty awesome.
Well, there's arm rippings. There's guy getting his head crushed by a weight machine. There's a girl getting her friggin' bare ass put onto some hot coals in a sauna while Toxie pisses on them to make them steam, you know?
So awesome.
There's just all this cool stuff in it.
The kid getting run over.
Yeah, because the main bullies in it, they have this game where they go run over people for points.
Just like Death Race 2000.
And they're all drinking and everything.
Yeah. Bozo. And that's the lead guy.
Yeah, Bozo. And he sees the kid riding down the street on his bike, and he goes to his girlfriend, how much for a kid on a bicycle? And I say that line all the frickin' time for no reason. I'll just be like, how much for a kid on a bicycle? And then they run over him. And when they run over him, they run over his head. But then they back over him just to make sure he's dead.
Yeah, I know.
So,
and it's gross. It's a good effect,
it's
right?
It's gross, but it's awesome.
Yeah.
So there's something to be said about Toxie.
Yeah.
Like, there's a reason he's the flagship of that company.
And then the movie is the flagship of the company.
And the movie's awesome.
Yeah, it really is.
But then came the sequels.
Yes. So Toxic Avenger Part 2 was released in 1989. Actually, they both were. I think they were filmed back-to-back.
They were filmed back-to-back, and the story behind that is that Troma actually came across some money because of some Japanese investors.
Okay.
Who gave them money to make the sequels, because apparently the first movie was a huge hit over there.
Wow.
And so they not only did they get the money to make these movies back-to-back, they've got a distribution deal with Warner Brothers for home video.
So awesome.
And
eh?
I was like, seriously? Toxic Avenger 2 is coming out on video from Warner Brothers? What's going on here? And I really don't... The thing about the Toxie sequels for me is that there's... The first movie's solid as a complete movie. The sequels are solid for scenes.
Yeah.
I found that each one was successively worse in the sense that part two has that opening scene that's set at the Tromaville home for blind people that Toxie's girlfriend goes to, where all these thugs come to take out Toxie. And he has this big elaborate fight scene where he's like mutilating all these bad guys to the tune of "It ain't mean a thing if it don't got that swing." And he's like killing people to that song.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he ends up going over to Japan to find his long lost father, and there's a little bit of sumo wrestling humor, and like,
yeah, I remember the sumo wrestling,
smushing a guy's nose with a fish press that makes the guy's nose look like a fish and everything. And I thought it was kind of fun, but it
was kind of cool that they shot it. I believe they shot it in Japan. Did. Yeah,
yeah, and I don't know.
And Phoebe Legere was the love interest.
Yeah,
it was a different girl than the first one. But this girl, I just knew her from a movie called Mondo New York. She was like a New York performance artist. Was Toxie's girlfriend blind in the first one too?
Yes, she was.
So was it the same? I think it was the same character, maybe.
Yeah, it was the same character. I think they actually changed her name, if I recall correctly, because I think she was called Claire in one of them, and then she was called Julie in the sequels or something along those ways. I think they kind of lost their continuity on the name of his girlfriend.
I definitely remember Phoebe more than the other girl.
I actually thought the other girl was much more attractive, though.
Andre Miranda was the other girl's name, yeah. But I guess I just knew Phoebe from being like kind of this weird performance.
And the same thing with 3 is that 3 had that scene. It's always the opening of the sequels, right? At the beginning of Toxie 3, these thugs...
The Last Temptation of Toxie.
Yeah, these thugs pull into a video store.
Oh, yeah, that's a classic
scene. And they start harassing them, and Toxie shows up. And slapstick gore ensues, you know? He's got a scene where he feeds a guy's hand to a friggin' VCR and it chews his hand up. And he takes this guy and he punches him in the stomach and pulls all his intestines out and proceeds to skip to them.
Oh, yeah.
He skips and he's going, "Tore your guts out, skip to my loo." You know, and it's awesome.
A totally classic scene, though. Like,
it's great, but then the rest of the movie is kind of,
because
it's about Toxie fighting this conglomerate, which turns out to be run by Satan.
Yeah, and he decides to work for them because he thinks it's the right thing, and then he gets tainted by
them.
And
that kind of lost my interest in Toxie until Citizen Toxie rolled around, which was part 4.
Yeah, and Citizen Toxie, it was super offensive.
I love Toxie.
Like, way
Citizen
more
Toxie.
Offensive than any of the other movies.
I actually love it because it's offensive, though, because it's got, like, lots of really off-color, tasteless humor about the handicapped.
Oh, my God, I know.
Like, so much.
Like, I was shocked, and I found that Troma kind of went this direction after Toxie 4, like, they really were pushing
it. Well, they were pushing it before that.
They
kind of started pushing
it
with
really, like, crossing lines almost.
Yeah, and there was, you know, they had them fighting, like, these other mutated guys, like the Mad Cow.
Yeah.
And there was, like, the Masturbator, who was this guy who just jerked off the entire time, and Toxie had to fight him.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a scene of his unborn babies fighting in the womb, and... It's about an alternate reality where the noxious offender comes and they like switch places.
Yeah.
And the noxious offender is kind of like an asshole, but everyone still thinks it's the real Toxie, so they treat him well, but then he starts being a dick to everybody. So it's a fun movie. I actually kind of like Citizen Toxie a lot more than the 2 and 3.
And that was co-written by Trent Haga.
Yeah.
He went on to make a really offensive movie called Dead Girl.
Yes.
Have you seen that one?
I've heard about it.
So it's not a trauma movie, but it's a movie about these guys that find this corpse in this, like...
this dead, hot, dead girl.
Yeah, and it's in this, like, abandoned asylum or something.
And, you know, when you find a dead girl, what do you decide to do usually? You decide to tell the cops, right? What do they decide to do?
They decide to have sex with it over.
Of course they do.
Yeah, it's really fucked up. But Trent Haga, he spent some time with Troma as well. And then went on to make that movie, so...
Yeah, he was in Tromeo and Juliet.
Yeah.
But, the weirdest thing about the Toxic series to me is the fact that they managed to spin that off to a kid's cartoon show.
Yeah, Toxic Crusaders.
How the hell did that happen?
I know. And it was like a Saturday morning cartoon, right?
Yeah, and it was like it had a message about how pollution is bad.
Well, trauma movies always have messages,
I know, but it's
right?
It was weird because you're going from a movie where he's ripping people's guts out and, like, you know, stomping on people and everything and to this cartoon, and it was really strange. They even spun that off into comic books and video games and action figures.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I don't even know how that happened.
I know. Well, I can understand the action figures for sure. The video game, like, again, well, I mean, if they had
figures make sense. But back then in the, like, late 80s and 90s, there wasn't this huge market for these horror action figures. So that's why I find it strange.
Yeah, that was before McFarlane and everything else. But, I can understand the cartoon in a way. I mean, at that time, Saturday morning cartoons were starting to struggle, so I could see why they'd be looking for material, especially if they'd been picked up by Warner Brothers. I mean, I can kind of see how that could happen, but pretty fucking bizarre when you're looking back on it now.
The thing that I find bizarre is just how vanilla it was.
The cartoon?
The cartoon. It was just so vanilla. It was nothing like the Toxie that I knew.
Yeah.
And I still remember that goddamn annoying theme song.
How did it go?
Toxic Crusaders, Toxic Crusaders. And then Michael G. Pollard, who most of us know from being a co-star of Bonnie and Clyde, and he was also in Sleepaway Camp 2, he voiced the main bad guy's sidekick.
Really?
Which I thought was weird, too.
So was Troma involved in the...
They were.
So with, like... Who, like, was Lloyd directing it, or?
No, I don't think so. I think they were just, like, consultants or something.
Wow.
It just seems really strange, because I would have never have pegged Toxic Avenger to be a Saturday morning cartoon. But then I thought about it just now, that around the same time, they also had an Attack of the Killer Tomatoes cartoon.
Did they really?
Yeah, so.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I kind of can see it now. It makes a little bit more sense to me. Maybe Saturday morning cartoons were grasping at straws, because they didn't have that 80s thing like we had with He-Man and G.I. Joe and, you know,
Scooby-Doo and Super
all those
Friends,
kind
yeah.
of things. Maybe it was a time when they were transitioning and they were just trying to find the next new...
Well, I do remember, like, the later days of Saturday morning cartoons, them being really kind of weak compared to what I... Now, I don't know if it was because I was getting older, but I mean, Saturday morning cartoons are not even, they're not nothing like when we
They don't
up.
Exist anymore.
So I think they were kind of fading out. So I would imagine that the Saturday morning programming people were probably looking for material. And who knows, man, but...
Well, Toxic Crusaders and Attack of the Killer Tomatoes.
It's pretty bizarre.
There's some friggin' material for you, right?
Yeah.
But Toxie, I can understand why he's their mascot.
Yeah, they've also made a musical of Toxic Avenger,
which
I
totally want to see when it tours.
Yeah, I wonder if it'll ever tour, but
because
I can see that. I can see it being a musical.
Yeah, it would
sure.
be fun. It would be fun, but it is their flagship character, their flagship movie. It is a great movie, the first one. I don't hesitate in recommending that movie to you.
No, the first one's amazing.
At all, and I've heard rumors of a part 5.
Oh, have you?
So we'll see what happens.
I've heard rumors that they're going to be making a PG remake as well.
Yeah, PG-13 remake with The Rock as Toxie.
Really?
That's what I've heard.
There's been a lot of rumors.
PG-13 and Toxic Avenger don't mix.
The Rock, I can't see it either.
Well, I mean, maybe if he was actually after he transformed, but who are they going to get to play Nerdy Melvin?
I don't know.
They're going to get that Clark fucking Duke guy from Hot Tub Time Machine?
Who's that guy?
The guy with the chubby dude with the glasses.
I don't remember.
Yeah, he's a nerd. Anyway, so after Toxic Avenger became a huge hit for Troma, they kept kind of on this bent, and they made a movie called Class of Nuke 'Em High.
Yep.
Which is kind of the next series that we wanted to touch on. It was made in 1986, had those same kind of themes with the, you know, toxic waste being bad and everything. And it was about Tromaville High School, because all of Troma's movies were set in Tromaville.
Yep.
For the most part. And it had them, you know, it had them smoking this this toxic waste tainted weed, which turned the honor students into the cretins, who were the bad punks of the school, and they would come.
I haven't seen this movie in so long.
They would beat everybody up, but there was also this couple, this cute couple who were there, and they smoked the weed, and the chick instantly gets pregnant with a mutant baby.
Nice.
And it's pretty awesome. I can't really explain this movie to you without you watching it, because it's such a weird pastiche of various things. It wants to be like a teen movie, but it's also got...
It's very 80s, I remember that.
Yeah, it's so 80s, but it's also got wicked monster effects in it.
Is that the one with the penis monster?
No, that's Tromeo.
Okay.
But this one's got a wicked effect where after she gives birth to this kind of slug creature, it grows and grows and grows to this alien-like giant monster who stalks the hallways of the high school. And at the end, it just massacres these cretins. And it's really awesome looking. It's like totally top-notch 80s monster movie effects.
Right on.
I mean, that's the thing about Troma. In the 80s, they might not have had the budgets, but they definitely did not skimp on the effects.
Yeah, or the gore or the nudity.
No, they delivered.
Like, you knew what you were getting when you were renting a Troma movie, yeah. Especially in this kind of golden era of the company. And A Class of Nuke 'Em High was co-directed by Richard Haynes, I believe his name is.
Yeah, and he made a slasher movie called Splatter University before that, which was not that great.
Yeah, but this is where Lloyd, you know, I mean, hers and Kaufman were still directing movies together, but Lloyd started co-directing and then sort of went off after this as well.
Well, and they also made sequels to this.
Yep. So part two. Yep.
These sequels were really super weak compared to even the Toxie sequels in my eyes.
Well, I do remember. Okay, so part two was Subhumanoid Meltdown in 1991. And this is where the Class of Nuke 'Em High went to college. So it was college years, I guess.
Yeah.
But I do remember the star of this movie, Brick Bronski. I do remember him. He's very memorable.
He was a lunkhead.
He was a total lunkhead, but kind of likable.
But it was about these mutant students who had mouths in their where their belly buttons were supposed to be, and they tried to get another mascot character because they had this like 30-foot mutated squirrel called Tromy, the nuclear radioactive squirrel, and they tried to make that into a recognizable character for Troma. I just didn't think it worked that well. I didn't really care for those sequels. They were just all over the place. They didn't have any real focus. They went too much for slapstick. They didn't have any real, you know, I don't know. It just seemed to be lacking for me.
Well, this is what I was saying. Like, Lloyd wasn't involved in directing these, and these were directed by a guy named Eric Luzel, and the second one was also co-directed with Donald Jackson, who did Hell Comes to Frogtown and a bunch of Rollerblade movies. Like
fucking Donald Jackson.
Rollerblade Warriors and
fuck.
Rollerblade Fury.
Or fucking
Rollerblade, whatever.
What was his Zen movie making concept? Him and that fucking Scott Shaw, who starred in all his movies, that this Zen movie concept where it's like we just put the cameras out and whatever fucking happens, and they made such fucking terrible movies.
Was Donald Jackson responsible
for
it? Oh, wow. I didn't know
Roller Gator and shit like that.
Right.
Ugh, they're painful to watch. I'm sorry.
So, and then Subhumanoid Meltdown, I don't remember what the year was, but
I think these two were shot back to back as well.
It might have been. I don't know if Jackson was involved with both of them, though. But that Eric Luzel was, and he had done some other Troma movies like Fortress of America.
Yeah, part three was called The Good, the Bad, and the Subhumanoid.
Yeah, and this one had Brick Bronski playing three roles.
Yeah, and we're The Good, the Bad, and the Wretched.
Oh, wow.
Oh, Clint Eastwood.
God, everything's a callback tonight.
What have you done? What have you done, Clint Eastwood?
So I don't really have much to say about The Good, the Bad, and the Subhumanoid.
Really,
it's been so long since
I haven't seen them in a long time. I just remember being hugely disappointed in them after Class of Nuke 'Em High.
Right.
Because Class of Nuke 'Em High, you know, it had that opening scene with the with the kid drinking from the water fountain, and it's green water, and he starts spewing green stuff out of his ears, and he punches out students, and then jumps out. He jumps out the window just like Toxie did, but lands on the ground, and he melts down and catches on fire and everything. And then one of the punker cretins goes, "Well, that's one way to evacuate the building." And then they roll the credits. And I mean, it's just that kind of. I found the aesthetic in 80s trauma movies to be a lot more campy, I guess, like more focused camp, I guess, because I just thought Class of Nuke'em High 2 and 3 weren't as focused.
Right.
But I've heard that Return to Class of Nuke'em High Volume 1, which just came out on Blu-ray last year.
Yeah, in 2013.
It's kind of a return to the original because it's supposed to be a loose remake. I haven't seen it. I do.
Well, it's because Lloyd came back to direct
it. I do have it at home.
Yeah.
And I haven't watched it yet, but I've heard it's more of a callback to the first one, so I'm kind of curious about that one.
Yeah, I'm really curious about that, and I know the part two of that's coming out this year, supposedly, as well.
Yeah, it's supposed to be coming out, because it was one of those ones where they made one movie, and then it was too long, so they split it.
Yeah.
So, we'll see. I've heard the second one's actually better than Volume 1.
Yeah, I'm curious to see what happens. I mean, I think Lloyd still has it. Like, he still knows how to offend, and he still knows how to kind of make
in
things
Volume 1, a girl's in love with a fucking duck. What more do you need? I mean, come on. What other movie but a troll movie is going to have a chick in love with a duck?
Like, she's really in love with a duck?
She's in love with a duck.
Is it like a real duck?
A real duck.
Wow. Does she...
I don't know. I haven't seen it.
Well, you didn't know what I was going to say.
There's also a lot of lesbians in it, apparently.
There's always lesbians in troll movies.
Well, you know, trauma's built on blood, boobs, and breasts and lesbians, apparently.
Apparently so. So
blood, boobs, beasts, and lesbians.
I think we should go through a few more of the movies that Kaufman was involved with as a director.
Okay.
Just because a lot of them are kind of the main trauma titles.
Yep.
And then we can get into some of the other ones afterwards.
Sure.
But so the next one that kind of came along in the 80s was Trauma's War. In 1988.
Which is a movie I have not seen in a long time, but I remember really liking when I saw it.
I remember really liking it, too. And, you know, the main premise... So this is what sort of Troma's take on terrorists and throwing, you know, making... Well, I guess sort of camping up the whole terrorism threat in the 80s. And I think it was also a reaction to Ronald Reagan's, you know... political stance on terrorism and war and stuff like that. But this has, it's pretty much a Caribbean island that some people travel to that happens to be a terrorist training camp. And it's just action and violence.
Yeah, it's I remember it being pretty ridiculous.
Yeah, it was super over the top.
But I also remember being highly entertained the entire time I was watching it.
Yeah.
And that's when I've really been curious to rewatch, but I'm kind of crossing my fingers that they're going to put it out on Blu-ray. That's why I haven't bought it yet.
Right. Now, I think this was a bit of a turning point for the company, though, because I think this one was, they did put a lot of money into this, especially
well, I think
on
it
the
was,
success
yeah,
of Toxie.
I think they put a lot of money into it, and then it didn't really do so well, so it kind of pushed them back on their budget levels. And
it might have even lost them. Like, I think they went back to being an indie company. Like, whatever relation they had with Warner Brothers at the time maybe was affected
or media
by this.
Yeah, I think they did lose a lot of cred because they sunk so much money into that movie and then it kind of didn't do as well.
And
as...
maybe not cred amongst fans.
No,
but
not amongst
cred
fans.
Amongst major studios.
Yeah, and
as a money-making
although
venture.
If you think about it, I don't know if Lloyd really gave a shit anyway.
Yeah, I don't. He doesn't seem like the type who gives a shit. I mean, he's pretty anti-corporate, always has been. That's why it's curious that they even got into bed with Warner Brothers in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it would be really interesting to hear how this really happened, like what really happened. But, you know, aside from having Lloyd in the room, we're not going to really know. I mean, there's unfortunately just not a lot out there about what really happened.
Right. So we speculate
possibly his books, but we'll get into those a bit later as well. So the Troma's War was in 1988, and then in 1990, again Kaufman Hers co-directing all of these. Sergeant Kabuki Man, NYPD.
Was that 90 or 95? five.
I've got 1990 written down.
Oh, okay. I've never seen it.
So this one I enjoyed quite a bit. Again, a very, very silly main character. And I wasn't actually expecting to like this one, but I really liked it. And a lot of it was to do the main actor, Rick Giannassi, playing a character called Harry Griswold. And he's just this kind of an almost a noirish type cop. And he gets, I can't remember what happens to him, but he gets turned into this kabuki man, superhero police officer guy. And, you know, this is filled with the usual trauma cheese and bad puns. And yeah. I did find this to be quite restrained for a trauma movie. There wasn't like abundant nudity and gore, but, you know, it was definitely clever and had stuff like flying chopsticks and parasol weapons and
yeah, flaming killer sushi, a flaming parasol and, or yeah, something.
Yeah, so it had the trauma elements, but it wasn't R-rated. But I still really enjoyed it. So it was
This is also the movie that gave them like kind of their sub mascot, because you always see Sergeant Kabuki Man as one of their secondary mascot characters now.
Yeah, totally. This movie.
And he was in Citizen Toxie as well.
You're right.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because I wonder why Kabuki Man never got a sequel.
It's interesting. You know, I've never seen it. I don't know why.
It's a fun movie, but it's not R-rated like the others. It's fun. I totally would recommend it. It's a well-made, and get another well-made trauma movie with a great lead character. I mean, the guy really carries the movie. So definitely like that one. Then in 1996, along came Troma's take on Shakespeare, of all things, which you wouldn't think would work, but it actually works quite well.
Do you want to know the thing about this?
What's that?
About Romeo and Juliet is, I fucking hate Shakespeare.
Me too.
With all my being.
I've tried to like Shakespeare. But
I hated Shakespeare in high school. I fucking hate all the people who masturbate all over Shakespeare. I just hate him. But Romeo and Juliet comes around and I'm like, maybe the Shakespeare cat's not so
bad.
Yeah,
I'm cool with the Capulets. You know, I wouldn't even know what that means unless I'd see Romeo and Juliet.
I'm just like, yeah, this is totally where I think this is the beginning of Troma going as over the top as humanly possible that you were saying they did in Citizen Toxie. I think this is really the kickoff point where they were like, you know what? We don't have the backing of this big money anymore. We're just going to do what the fuck we want.
Exactly.
And if we offend people, so be it.
Yeah.
And,
well, I didn't find this to be quite as offensive as Citizen Toxie.
Well, no, but this is the beginning
definitely
of them going down that road.
It was definitely, and I found this had, and I don't know if it was the people he was hiring, but it definitely was giving Troma more of a punk rock aesthetic.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it was just the timing, because, you know, you were getting a lot of like, you know, just the way that youth culture was, you know. You know, this is when Green Day was big and stuff. You were just finding a lot of the young people that were interested in filmmaking. I mean, I guess you could call them early hipsters, but I mean, they just had a certain look to them, and you were seeing a lot of that type of character in Troma movies, starting from Romeo and Juliet.
Well, yeah, and this is also notable for being written by James Gunn,
who, of course, has gone on to
Guardians of the Galaxy,
yeah,
Slither.
But Guardians of the Galaxy, I mean, he had probably the biggest movie of the summer.
Well, second highest grossing movie of last year after American Sniper now, right?
So, yeah.
I mean, this is a guy who started with Troma. His brother, Sean Gunn, also co-stars in the movie.
Yeah.
And it did make me like Shakespeare, and I didn't think anything could come along that would make that humanly possible.
Yeah.
And yeah, Tromeo's just a bizarre movie in itself. Lemmy from Motorhead is the narrator.
Yeah, so this was written by Kaufman and James
Gunn.
Yeah, and directed by Kaufman solely.
Yeah.
So this is also notable because hers was not co-directing.
Right. One. And, you know, it's got that penis monster you were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
And it's actually quite, I remember it being quite serious for a Troma movie. Like, it's got all the stuff in it that you'd expect from a Troma movie, but it's also really faithful to Romeo and Juliet,
yeah,
which is kind of weird.
Well, and they keep the character names, and not that I know the story too well, other than the obvious, you know.
Yeah.
But I mean, and I think it's very well acted. He managed to get an actress named Jane Jensen and an actor named Will Keenan, but Jensen, I thought she rocked it as Juliet, especially. I thought they both did a really good job, but her in particular, I thought she really carried the movie quite well and was able to pull off like a fucking Shakespeare adaptation in Tromaville.
Yeah, I it was one of those unexpected things where I went into it thinking, what is this going to be? And then I came out of it going, you know what? That was pretty rad.
Yeah, it was pretty rad.
And I just, I had low expectations because by the time Romeo and Juliet came out in 96, I was kind of off the trauma bandwagon for there because, you know, the Class of Nukem High sequels and the Toxie sequels kind of soured me to the brand a tiny bit, admittedly. And some of the stuff they were putting out on DVD and VHS in the late 90s weren't really appealing to me that much.
Yeah.
So I kind of was like, I always had that respect and adoration for trauma in me because that's never going to go away.
Yeah.
But it's just, I found it to be like, the stuff they were putting out at the time wasn't really appealing to me. So for Tromeo to come out and be appealing to me was something in itself.
Yeah.
Because I had kind of written them off, admittedly.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And just back to Jensen for a second. She also was an established, well, I don't know how established, but she was a singer-songwriter. She's put out some records. She did put out a record around the time of this movie called Comic Book Horror. That's actually quite a good album, so I would recommend that if you're a fan of this movie at all and are more curious about Jane Jensen and what she's up to. Check out that record, and she's probably put out I think 3 or 4 CDs since.
Mm-hmm.
But it was an interesting direction for Troma to take, very risky.
Yeah.
But they've never been afraid of that.
Nope.
But I thought it was pretty cool how they were able to take on Shakespeare and make it into the, like, this kind of punk rock fantasy with the whole Troma aesthetic to it.
But really neat. Being super faithful.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So following that, in 1999, they came out with Terror Firmer.
Yeah.
So this is, from what I understand, this is a pretty self-referential movie.
Well, yeah, it totally is. It's kind of loosely based on his book, Everything I Know About Filmmaking I Learned from the Toxic Avenger, which he co-wrote with James Gunn.
Okay.
And is a superb book. I highly recommend you grab that book. It's a great look at what makes Troma tick. I have it at home on my bookshelf. I haven't read it in a little while, but I remember thinking it was like super awesome when I did read it.
I thought it was like Make Your Own Damn Movies.
No, that's his book, his follow-up book.
Oh, okay. That's the one I have. The
first book is called Everything I Know About Filmmaking I Learned from the Toxic Avenger.
Okay, cool.
And it kind of covers the history of Troma and all that stuff. Kind of a lot of the stuff we've been talking about, but a lot more in-depth, obviously.
Right.
And it was a great book, but Terra Firma was loosely based on that book. Because it's about, you know, them making a movie, and I believe he plays himself, or he plays like a caricature of himself.
Yeah, I think it's more of a caricature. And, I haven't seen this, so I can't.
It's about
really...
people being killed by a slasher on the set of this super low budget B movie that they're making.
Right.
So I've seen this once a long time ago, and I kind of remember not really digging it that much. So I don't have a lot to add to it. I know it's got quite the cult following now.
I've never seen it, but I've heard it's really good.
I think I'd like to rewatch it just because I think I might appreciate it a lot more now. I remember one thing about it was that I felt it was too long because it was almost 2 hours long.
Right.
So I'm of the school of where if you're making a B movie, it should be about 90 minutes.
Absolutely.
Like nice and compact, no real filler, no bloating. And I found that some Troma movies suffer from bloating. Like, even Romeo and Juliet's an hour and 47 minutes long.
It's too long.
I mean, it's too long. It's still a good movie. And even, like, Toxie 3 was an hour and 40-some minutes long.
Yeah.
I mean, the original Toxie movie's only 82 fucking minutes.
And that's where it should be.
I mean...
80 to 100. 80 to 90. Sorry.
I mean... Sure, you want to throw as much as you can into your movies, but I found that was a contributing factor to my not liking Terror Firmer as much as I should have.
Right.
Because it's got Debbie Rochon in it. It's got all these, like, good names in it.
And, yeah, Will Keenan came back from Tromeo and Trent Haga again.
Yeah, and it's very self-referential, very self-deprecating.
Right.
And so I feel like I would probably like it more now, though.
Yeah, it's one of those ones I know I'd probably dig, but I've just never gotten around to it. And again, because, you know, kind of Troma had lost its luster a bit at that point.
Yeah.
And just wasn't as interested as I used to be. But
yeah, I was out of the loop with them for a while because I kind of like, you know, like you said, their glow wasn't quite as there because I got older and more cynical, I think.
Yeah. So after that, so that was in 1999. And in 2006, Lloyd made another return with Poultrygeist, Night of the Chicken Dead.
And this is what I have not seen this movie, but I've heard that it's the craziest fucking movie he's made.
Yeah, so, yeah, I don't even know what to say about this movie. Okay, so first of all, it does suffer from the same overlong thing you were talking about, and Lloyd really needs to tighten it up. I really think he'd be a lot more successful if he'd make these movies 90 minutes instead of going over the two-hour mark. At any rate, so this one's a musical, which is bizarre enough in itself, just because the songs are
But it's also a riff on Poltergeist in a way, because it's about a fast food chicken restaurant being built over an Indian burial ground.
It totally is, yeah.
Which makes people, when they eat this tainted chicken, don't they become like chicken zombies?
Yeah, it's fucked up, man. Like, this is one of those movies where it's just like, it was like fucking watching, I felt like I was at a Gwar concert watching this thing. There was so
That's not a bad thing.
No, I know, but there was just, there was so much fluid on the screen. Like, every fucking 2 seconds, there was fluid, whatever kind of fluid you can imagine.
I've seen the first flowing. I've seen the first 10 minutes where the nerdy guy gets the hot chick in the graveyard and then ends up having a zombie reach through his ass and out his mouth.
It's just,
and if the rest of the movie's like that, I'm probably on board.
Yeah, it's just at over 2 hours.
Oh, okay.
By the end of it, you're just like, okay, enough. Like, you know, it was just, it's just so much, and you're just done.
There is a breaking point on B movies.
Yeah, yeah.
Where it stops being fun and starts being kind of a drag.
Yeah, and this was a fun movie, but just too much, too long. So, but it was definitely, like, I was shocked. I was sitting there like, I can't fucking believe that this is even happening. It was so over the top.
Well,
so
I guess that's a sign of a success.
The 15-year-old me would have fucking loved this.
Yeah.
You know, but
not so much the adult you.
Well, I didn't hate it.
Yeah, I find that I'm a lot more cynical about not just Troma in general, just like these campy B movies in general. I find I'm a lot more cynical than I was when I was younger.
Yeah, but I just think, like, if this had come out in the, you know, right after Toxie, I would have been blown away being at that age. And again, it just sort of illustrates the whole, like, why it's kind of sucks that we're living in a different time, because I just can't see kids nowadays. Frankly, I can't see kids nowadays even watching fucking movies, but never mind, like, discovering this movie by downloading it off their torrent
site. Well, maybe they can pull themselves away from Call of Duty.
Yeah.
And watch some Troma movies.
Yeah, because, I mean, if I had seen this as a teenager, Poltergeist, I would have been all over it. And I think it's really neat that Lloyd's been able to keep that youthful exuberance for this type of material.
Well, that's
Lloyd's got to be in his late
70.
60s. Yeah. And to be able to still have that and be jazzed on this, and to be playing a part, he plays a part in this, as and it's a musical, and it's all fucked, and his part's really fucked up.
Doesn't he also have full frontal?
I might have blocked it, man, because if that happened, I think I wouldn't be blocking that.
But I always found the interesting thing about him is that their movies are silly, but he takes everything else seriously. You know, he takes the business seriously. He takes supporting independent cinema seriously. He takes all that stuff seriously, and that's to be commended, because, you know, he could be just some schlub making these fucking cheesy B movies, which he is making these cheesy B movies, but he's balancing it with actual seriousness, respect. You know, they might goof around when they're making these movies, but after they're done, they take themselves seriously. Like, they're out there promoting the product and making sure that it gets known, and you know, they're doing the best they can.
Yeah.
And, you know, I respect that, because that drive. It's 40 years, man. What other independent film companies lasted 40 years?
Yeah, none.
Exactly.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I can't even think of one that's lasted that long consistently and still have an office and still are running. And, you know, Lloyd is just such a fixture. I actually was able to meet him. I went to the American Film Market a few years ago and walked into the trauma room, and Lloyd was there. And it was one of those moments in your life where it's like you've seen this guy so much. Like, you just know him so well. It was almost surreal. Like, it was like I was looking at like a live cartoon. Like, I couldn't even believe he was there. It was the weirdest thing.
I always feel like if I ever met him, he'd just be like, "Greetings from Troma."
He is like that. Like, it was the weirdest thing. And like, it was just like watching. I felt like I was watching my TV. Yeah. It was like when I went to the Grand Canyon and saw the Grand Canyon. It was like just looking at a painting, and that's kind of what Lloyd was like. It was like I was watching my TV. Even though he was right in front of me, it was a really bizarre experience. But so that's where we're at with what Lloyd's directed. I mean, after Poltergeist obviously came the Nukem High sequels, yep, that Chris mentioned earlier. But another thing that Troma's really known for is distribution of other people's movies.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole slew of them that I'm sure we'll come up with a few.
Very interesting approach to distribution, I find, though.
Yeah.
Because they're buying up these indie movies, and then what they're doing is they're giving them these catchy titles a lot of the times.
Yeah.
And they're giving them artwork to match. And I always knew Troma movies from that, too.
Yeah.
Like, if I was in the video store in the 80s, I would look for those movies, because
you'd look for the Troma logo.
I would look for the Troma logo in the bottom left corner of the box always, but I would also kind of know them just by looking at the titles of movies.
Yeah.
Like, you could always tell a Troma movie, and that's why the brand is probably still strong.
Well, and some other companies were caught on to that as well, and were like putting out movies like the Radioactive Reporter.
Yeah.
What's that one?
Revenge of the Radioactive Reporter.
Yeah, that wasn't a Troma movie, no. But they were certainly trying to cash in on that, like, Troma naming device.
Right. So why don't we talk about... I mean, we're not going to go too in-depth into the next bunch of titles,
big
but...
big ones I think we should mention.
Let's just talk about the main ones that everybody knows.
That Troma distributed.
Yeah,
so the first one that comes to mind for me would be Bloodsucking Freaks.
Which is exactly what I was going to say.
Joel M. Reed movie from the early 70s.
75.
Yeah, I think it was originally called The Incredible Torture Show or something like that. But Troma called it Bloodsucking Freaks. And this is this fucked up movie about this guy named Sardou and his little person assistant, Ralphus. And they kidnap women and just perform weird acts on them. Like, it's pretty much a grand guignol show.
I don't know how to say it either.
Like a live action torture
show.
It's kind of like
a successor to H.G. Lewis's Wizard of Gore in a way.
Yeah. With the little person, Ralphus. But I love this movie. I've seen it a few times, and
I have this movie on Blu-ray.
Yeah. I mean, it's super fucking offensive, but I've always enjoyed it. And, you know, and then Troma got their hands on it. They put it out on DVD, on VHS, but then they put it out on DVD. And, you know, a notable thing about the first DVD that Troma put out of this was that it had a young, before he was a filmmaker even, Eli Roth doing a commentary as a fan. And and Troma always did a good job with their DVDs of, like, putting on lots of special features and commentary tracks and all that
was carried over to the Blu-ray, so you know.
Yeah, but Bloodsucking Freaks is definitely the one of the movies when I think of Troma distribution that really pops into my head.
Well, I just remember certain snippets of this movie. Like, it's so offensive. I mean, there's people with their rears being used as a dartboard, and
yeah,
you know, there's that famous scene with the straw them sucking someone's brain out through
the
straw.
The surgeon comes
and drills
a hole in a woman's head and then sucks her brain out.
I just don't understand how a movie like that got made.
Well, then, like, Ralphus, like, I think some woman's head gets severed, and then he, like, I think he actually, if memory serves,
he
pulls the teeth out, I think, and then gets head from the head.
Okay, right. But it's funny, though, because it's got its fans. I mean, even wrestler Chris Jericho is a huge Bloodsucking Freaks fan.
Yeah, and I'm definitely a fan, too.
He had a sidekick when he was in the WWE called Ralphus.
Did he really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And it's named after Ralphus from Bloodsucking Freaks.
Wow, I don't know whatever happened to Ralphus.
Because he's such a huge freak for that movie.
Yeah.
Freak. I didn't mean that as a joke, but it came out that way. But yeah, that's definitely, I'd say that's probably the most notable one they distributed.
There's some others,
like Surf Nazis Must Die, for example.
Absolutely.
Yep. Which, you know, when you're a kid and you see the title Surf Nazis Must Die and you see a guy on a surfboard with a chainsaw on the bottom of it, you're like, I'm in.
Yeah.
And I really don't remember a lot about this movie because I haven't seen it in a while. I just remember there's a really big, burly, black woman whose last name is Washington or something like that, who decides to kill a bunch of these surf Nazis who are harassing the beach.
Right.
And I actually think the movie was less violent than it should be with a title like that.
I don't remember much about this, but it had a hell of a title.
Hell of a title.
And I don't know if Trauma was responsible for the title or what, but I don't know. Like, everyone who was into B-movies in the 80s knows Surf Nazis.
It's still famous.
Yeah. So the next one I've got on my list would be Cannibal the Musical.
Yeah.
So this is Trey Parker and Matt Stone, who created South Park. This was their musical version of the story of Alfred Packard, who was a I guess it was in the Gold Rush era.
Mm-hmm.
This guy who was stuck in the wilderness and ended up eating the people he was with. It's also been made into another movie called Ravenous that tells the same story, but in a much more serious manner.
Yeah, no, Ravenous doesn't have musical numbers.
No. And I don't know. I don't think I've actually seen Cannibal the Musical. I've seen the stage play, but I don't think I've actually seen the movie.
I like the movie. It's got some weird shit in it. It's got like a repetitive song, Let's Build a Snowman.
Oh, yeah.
Where this guy is so obsessed with making snowmen that it's a running joke in the movie about building a snowman. And there's a payoff in it that's super awesome.
Right on.
And it's a fun movie. It's super low budget. You can tell. But you can kind of see where they got a lot of the humor for South Park from.
Yeah.
I mean, and I've always found that Trey Parker and Matt Stone have really been good at coming up with their own songs for everything, because they had songs for South Park they made up. Team America had some really wicked songs in it. Orgasmo had that wicked, now you're a man. So, I mean, I just think it's interesting because they're another group that were given their break by Troma in a way.
Yeah, for sure.
So there's that one. That's a really notable one. For me, another notable one would have to be Redneck Zombies.
Yeah.
Which is not a great movie.
Admittedly. I enjoyed it.
It's a super shot on VHS zombie
movie.
With a barrel of toxic waste being turned into moonshine, turning hillbillies into zombies. It's campy as hell.
Yep.
It's got a kind of a hero who's like this black military guy. And I remember him like coming and running over a hill towards some people going, there's a bodacious herd of redneck zombies heading this way. And just, I remember that. And there's this guy called the Tobacco Man in it who wore this kind of burlap sack over his head. And all they would go buy tobacco off him. And he talked like with this like coffer's voice, smoker's voice, like, hey, you dare to call the river? And he didn't make any sense. And they were like buying the chewing tobacco off him, and they'd sing this song, dips, dips, we want dips and some for daddy's pipe. And it's a weird fucking movie.
Well, it's interesting how Troma was able to like find movies like this that really fit in with what they were doing. Because that sounds like a Troma movie, right? Even though it wasn't really a Troma movie.
Well, even the director, Percelis Lunas, I think that's how you say his name.
Pericles,
He went on to work on the Toxic Avenger sequels.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. They did kind of tie in to Troma.
Yeah.
The one that I really like, because we were talking about it earlier today, was Rabbit Grannies.
Yeah.
Which is a weird discovery for me, because I saw that VHS cover of those weird looking grannies and the little girl screaming with the tagline, "Grandmother, what big teeth you have."
Yeah.
And it was like this Belgium horror movie about this birthday party for these two older ladies who the black sheep relative shows up with this box with this smoke in it that turns them into demons. And then they spend the whole dinner party like gorily killing everybody at the party. And I just remember some of the outrageous gore shots in it. Like there's a scene where her demon hand shoots across the table and pulls someone towards her with the demon hand and then chews on their head like they're eating a fucking melon.
Nice.
And like chopping the cake in half with their big demon claw and all this stuff. It's really cool.
Right on. That's great. just cool how they are able to find movies like this to really fit in. No, I have another one here that doesn't really fit in, but it's a fucking awesome movie, and I really commend Troma for picking it up.
I think I know where you're going.
This is called Combat Shock.
I knew it.
Yeah, so this is 1984, directed by Buddy Giovinazzo. And, I mean, I'd like to talk at length about Combat Shock in a future episode, maybe, but this is a really bleak fucking movie about a Vietnam vet.
I feel like we should maybe have a future episode about Vietnam vets, because there's a lot of movies
we could find lots.
I mean, there's like Thou Shalt Not Kill Except, and there's Combat Shock. There's all these kind of movies.
First Blood even, right?
Executioner or whatever it is. Exterminator, sorry.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But this one in particular, it's pretty much just a day in the life of this fucked up Vietnam vet guy.
It's probably the most bleak movie Troma's put out, for sure.
It's super bleak, and it's, it's super, super downbeat. Super low budget, but it's also one interesting thing that does tie it into Troma is it's super New York. Like I really, I don't know if it's New York or New Jersey, but it is, you definitely get that urban decay thing that was kind of popular at the time. Anyway, it's a fucking awesome movie. And like Troma initially marketed it kind of it almost looked like it was a action movie, but totally not.
Well, when they first marketed it, they had this hand-drawn poster which had him and his guy in his war helmet shooting with explosions in the background and everything.
Yeah.
And then when they just put it out a few years ago on their Troma piece collection, the DVD had the main character holding a gun up to his temple like he was going to kill himself.
Yeah, it was definitely
so,
that.
So they definitely changed,
was more
they changed the artwork
to
represent the product, which I think, you know, I think they made their money with that lurid artwork at first, and then they realized what kind of movie they had on their hands and you know, corrected it, I guess.
Yeah, but again, it's a great movie, and they were able to give it the respect it deserved, with the DVD release. But
the people behind the marketing at Troma, they were fucking geniuses.
Oh, yeah.
Just because their boxes were so eye-drawing, and their titles, man. I mean, let's just shoot over their titles here. What, like Chopper Chicks in Zombie Town?
Yeah.
And, you know, what's another one?
Nymphoid Barbarian and Dinosaur Hell.
Fat Guy Goes Nutsoid.
Yeah.
Dead Dudes in the House.
Teenage Cat Girls in Heat.
Yeah.
Maniac Nurses Find Ecstasy.
Yep.
Blondes Have More Guns.
Blood Hook, which is about a killer slasher movie about a guy killing people with a giant fish hook and reeling them in. Well, that's notable for being directed by one of the guys responsible for Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah. Blades, which is Jaws on a golf course, only with a possessed power mower. So, I mean, there's all these movies they made. Killer Condom.
Yeah.
Killer Nerd.
Igor and the Lunatics. Yeah. Beware Children at Play.
Yeah.
Like, these are all titles I think of when I think of Troma. Tomcat Angels, and they all
Lust
had great
for Freedom.
Yeah, they all had Fortress of America with KKK America.
Don't mess with my sister.
Yeah,
you know,
like, these were all movies that you think of when you like when I think of Troma. These are the titles that are
and they're still
in my
doing
head.
Stuff like that. I mean, look at the movies they've put out in the last 3-4 years. We've got that. I just discovered this Chilean short film called Banana Motherfucker.
Right.
That Troma put out on DVD most recently. They've got that Astron 9 movie, Father's Day.
Astron 6,
which is totally Troma in its delivery.
Oh, yeah.
It's a group of guys from Toronto, Ontario, who made this, like, rape revenge movie, only it's the dad who gets raped.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. And they also made Manborg, which a lot of us, our listeners, will know.
Yeah, I think Troma also put out a compilation of their short films, Astron 6's short films.
Yeah, they did. And, you know, they also put out... weird. They put out some serious movies here and there. They made Student Confidential, which was actually a way more serious movie than I thought it was going to be, where it was about troubled high school kids. It was campy, but it also had like a serious angle to it. And they kept putting out these movies where they cashed in so heavily on their marketing.
Yeah.
And I remember walking into those video stores and being like, holy fuck, I got to see this movie. Stuff Stephanie in the Incinerator. What the hell is that?
Was that a Troma movie?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like a couple of other ones that I remember. And actually, they were... Troma was a reason that... Well, I don't know if I'd say they were the reason, but they certainly could have been, that introduced me to some, you know, directors I really like. I mean, I know they picked up New Gladiators, which was like Lucio Fulci's version of The Running Man. They put out a... They initially put out Dario Argento's Stendhal Syndrome.
Yep.
I mean, now Troma was never known for putting out epic fucking transfers of these movies.
No.
But they still put them out, and yeah, when no one else was.
They were the people who originally put out Christmas Evil on
DVD. Yep.
Which is, for me, one of the most underrated holiday thriller horror movies.
Yeah, we talked about that in our Christmas episode. I think they put out Graduation Day as well.
They put
initially.
Out the original Graduation. Actually, they... Vinegar Syndrome has put those both out on Blu-ray recently,
right.
But I believe they're still working in conjunction with Troma on this.
Right.
Yeah.
Another one was a great biker movie that I've always loved called Satan Sadist.
Isn't that Al Adamson?
Al Adamson directed, yeah. But Troma put that out as well. And so, yeah, they've been able to find, like, oh, and another one that I actually just discovered last night, but I think they put out Miyazaki's My Neighbor Totoro.
They
originally did that, which is an animated movie.
They had a sub company called 50th Street Pictures,
right,
which put that out.
Nice. And that's a great fucking movie, but like, it's an animated movie from Hayao Miyazaki, who's a very famous Japanese animator. But Troma, I think, was the one who kind of helped bring him over here.
And they also bought out the Rhone Group, who have a lot of classic films in their catalog. They bought that catalog
right, like
up.
They had like White Zombie.
Yeah, they've been putting out a bunch of that stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, the thing I'm trying to say here is that they made these B-movies. They come in, they quick and easy market them, get people like us to rent them. But at the same time, they respect movies.
Yeah.
Like, they are movie fans, and you can tell. And, you know, there might be, like, the difference for me between what Lloyd Kaufman's doing with Troma and what someone like Charlie Band is doing with Full Moon is, I think that Charlie Band now has got to the point where he's just in it for the money.
Yeah.
Whereas I feel like Lloyd's not. He's in it because he just, you know, he likes to support independent film. He loves film. And that is why I respect him still, even though I might not quite be into their movies as much as I once was.
Yeah, and I mean, I think Troma's also been a real proponent for independent filmmakers. I know, I don't think it's nearly what it used to be, but about 10, 15 years ago, I know that Troma sort of did an answer to Sundance Film Festival Troma Dance Film Festival, which they also, I believe, did in Park City, Utah.
Yes, they did.
And it was more for underground filmmakers than, you know, as opposed to the mainstream, but, you know, as opposed to more like kind of art films that would be playing at Sundance or like films with big stars. This is more for the underground, and they did it at the same time. So people that weren't on that other level had a chance to have their stuff seen and screened. And, you know, I think Troma's also been a really great way for some indie filmmakers to get their stuff out there. Now, I know some indie filmmakers might not, you know, totally agree with the, like, the terms of distribution arrangements with Troma. I mean, I have heard that, you know, they feel like, you know, maybe the deal is more in Troma's best interest. But at the same time, you got to look at it like, you know, this is a company that's going to get shit out there as well. I mean, especially in today's day and age where people are putting their stuff up for free on YouTube, at least Troma was like doing something for you. And I really think that, you know, maybe they haven't always gotten the best shake that way, because like you said, I think Lloyd really does have filmmakers' best interests at heart, even though, you know, everyone's a cynic nowadays, but I truly believe that that's Lloyd's mission statement has always been that way, and Michael Hirst for that matter. And I don't think they've really strayed too far from that over the years.
No, they've always been proponents of supporting indie film.
Yeah.
And they have proof positive that they do.
And they've always been against the man. I mean, they've always been kind of anti-corporate. There's always been environmental messages. There's always been political messages. I think they've really stood for a lot of cool things. And, you know, you look at a guy like James Gunn and you're just like, wow, you know, like this really is an important piece of our culture.
Mm-hmm.
And Troma's still there. If you were ever in New York City, you can go on a tour of Troma's studio, I believe, whenever you want. In Hell's Kitchen. And I still think they're pretty cool. I still think they're kind of relevant. And I'm really glad Lloyd's still making movies.
I really, really hope they can continue as long as humanly possible.
Yeah, me too.
Because they are definitely a gem in the B-movie community. They have been around 40 years. If they want to stick around for another 40 years, I'm perfectly fine with that.
Yeah, and it would just be, you know, even though it
I
may
feel
not...
like they would have to find a suitable successor.
Well, I don't know if he will, though. But I mean, as long as we've been around, you know, even though we're not as psyched on Troma movies like mm-hmm. we were back when we were growing up, I just think the world without Troma would be kind of a dark place.
Why not? It's like we're not as psyched on Troma movies as we are, but I have bought almost every single Blu-ray they've put out. That's got to say something about the power of that brand name.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, I own Poltergeist on Blu-ray. I own Return to Nukem High on Blu-ray. I haven't watched them yet, but I still bought them sight unseen because of that Troma name.
Yeah,
and because
for sure.
I knew what I was expecting going in.
Yeah.
So that says something.
Yeah, and they've also, you know, I mean, Tiffany Shepis and Debbie Rochon, like, you know, they're great actresses and they've done really well for themselves in B-movies, but I think Troma was a real help for them as well.
They started out as Tromettes.
Yeah, I mean, we've just been talking about James Gunn over and over and Trent Haga, but I just thought we should throw those girls in there as well.
For sure.
They've definitely benefited from Troma.
For sure. So I think we've covered Troma pretty well.
Yep.
Why don't we just throw out, we'll wrap this up here, but let's throw out the essential Troma titles, what we believe would be. I mean, obviously it's going to be Toxic Avenger, the first one.
Are we including distribution or just Troma?
We can
produced?
Do both. Okay. We can do both. And we're also going to include Class of Nukem High. Those two are givens.
Yeah.
What are some titles that we think that you should check out if you're new to Troma and you want to kind of get an idea of the company?
Well, I would definitely throw in Tromeo and Juliet just because it's so unique.
Mm-hmm. Bloodsucking Freaks.
From distribution point, yeah. I mean, if we're just looking at the brand in general, yeah, for sure, Bloodsucking Freaks.
Yeah, and you know, like, I've mentioned all these movies like Chopper Chicks and all that, but, I mean, for essential Troma, I was trying to think, and I honestly think Redneck Zombies is kind of essential Troma.
Well, I do, too. I mean, I definitely think it shows the indie aesthetic, and I certainly associate that movie with Troma.
For sure.
And I'd also probably throw in Sergeant Kabuki Man.
Yeah.
And just because it's another one of their sort of flagship characters, and you know, even though it's not as R-rated as the other ones, I still think it's a really fun, well-made movie.
Yep.
Yeah.
So there you have it, folks. I think that's all we got to say about Troma today. If you liked what you heard, why don't you go visit us over on Facebook at facebook.com/GBW podcast, or you can follow us at Twitter at GBW podcast. And as always, we would like you to go and subscribe to us on iTunes, give us a rating and things like that. And if you have anything you want to tell us about Troma, your favorite movies or whatever, drop us a line. Let us know.
Yeah, you can also get us on the web at www.thevideograveyard.com/GBW podcast.
Okay, that's it.
Have yourself a Tromalicious day. This is Josh signing off.
See you later.